Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Helgi Seetzen, pioneering chairman, CEO, and world innovation technology leader. Helgi, you just have an amazing background, so thank you for sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Now, you are a noted pioneering innovator, and you've got so many patents and remarkable background. Can you share some useful lessons, for example, from your Brightside Technologies role?
Certainly. I've spent my whole career at the interface between sort of scientific discovery at the university environment and productization and commercialization thereof in startups as well as large companies. And not only is an interface very exciting, it also gives you the opportunity to sort of see two facets of what we conventionally call innovation, right? You have deep discovery matched with, you know, very organized, high-volume production. And when you do that, the thing you learn is really that, one, you need to surround yourself with smart people, and two, you need to surround yourself with good people. And I don't mean good in the sense of smart or capable. I mean the sense of good at heart, people. You know, when you take these early risks, when you build these startups, you need people who understand that there is a lot of ambiguity, that there is a lot of uncertainty in startups. And so a lot of times when things go wrong, you need people that have the intellectual ability to make it right, but also the sort of moral fortitude to stick by the process and, you know, get something across the line, even when things are a little bit shaky.
You know, it's an interesting comment. I did an interview recently with Eric Jackson, who's the CEO of CapLinked, and he's part of the PayPal Mafia. But he kind of said the same thing. He says you're going to have lots of ups and downs, and you've got to try to stay even keel throughout that process and sort of have colleagues that are somewhat the same. So it's interesting that you share the same kind of experiences with our audience. Now, you did some really interesting things at Brightside. Do you want to share any of that, what you did at Brightside?
Sure. So Brightside was an interesting adventure. It was a startup that we built around technology originally developed by us at the University of British Columbia. We then took it into a startup. In fact, we first created a company called Sunnybrook, which developed a number of display technologies. And then ultimately, we spun out, with the lessons learned from Sunnybrook, we spun out Brightside, which became really an aggregator. It became a collector of interesting technologies in the multimedia space from quite a few universities. We worked with UBC, obviously, but also another almost a dozen universities across the globe, from the UK, from Germany, US, Canada. We brought together all these brilliant people and developed an end-to-end solution to go from basically the capture of images to the display of images and everything in between, so processing, post-production, and so forth, distribution, to enable a new kind of image experience that we called high dynamic range, HDR. You know, this was almost a decade ago that this started, actually by now exactly a decade ago, and it was really gratifying. It was at the Consumer Electronics Show just a few months ago in January in Las Vegas, and you know, at that point, the technology that had emerged out of this research, which is now called LED TV, had gone into, by that point, over 150 million devices. So that was phenomenal to see that over the course of a decade, really something went from a small idea, a first prototype that we built, to you know, to an environment where dozens and later hundreds of people worked on this technology, and then ultimately mass manufacturing, where now tens of thousands of people are building these things for tens of millions of customers.
You know, it's kind of fascinating. I actually did the interview of, I think it was your chairman or first CEO, and when the LED concept was still in prototype, and he showed me, and I remember looking at it and thinking, my God, it looks brighter than real.
Yeah,
it was quite, in fact, we did an interview afterwards, so it's just amazing. And so it's good to see sort of from that prototype that I saw to, and I was also at CES, and as you mentioned, you know, LED sort of based technologies is just everywhere. And it's good to see this sort of come full circle. Now, I know that you also did work with Dolby. So can you talk about that work and some lessons you can share?
Sure. So Dolby Labs was effectively the continuation of Brightside. So Brightside was acquired by Dolby in 2007. And it really was the next stage of the voyage. If you want, you know, if you think about the LED TV technology in the early days at UBC, that was really the research stage. We were just doing pure R&D to discover how to solve this fundamental problem. And then Brightside was what I think of the innovation stage, where, you know, our job became not so much inventing things, though there was quite a lot of invention as well, but really innovating, really taking these early discoveries into demonstrators like the ones you saw to make it real for people. Like, we believed, but we had to get the whole world to believe, and we had to have, you know, journalists and reporters like you see this and tell the rest of the world that this actually looks good. And then Dolby, when Dolby acquired Brightside, it really heralded this next phase of broad adoption, right? Dolby was the platform with the company where we worked as a large team on licensing this technology to Sony and Sharp and you know, all these other TV companies that could today offer these technologies, build reference designs, you know, take that prototype that you saw and turn it into something that you could hand over to a Sony and say, here's this thing. Is this, you know, 200-page piece of paper, and if you follow the recipe in that 200-page document, then you're going to get a display that you can sell to tens of millions of people, and it will work, and it will perform, and the images will look good. And so that was really interesting for me to sort of see the last stage of the pipeline, if you want, and lead a team of engineers and design people to basically bring it to mass market effectively.
You know, it's kind of a fascinating story, and it's interesting that you have this background at UBC, and I did an interview with Murray Goldberg, and of course, he took some of that research that he did, and he commercialized it into, some of the online kind of teaching and learning technologies that are available worldwide, and then, of course, there's Z-Wave, again, sort of based out of UBC. Do you know any of those fellows, by any chance?
Very much so, yeah. So one of the founders... Maria Clave, who was an investor and on the board of director of Brightside and Sunnybrook, actually, a phenomenal lady. She at the time was the dean of science at UBC, and she was also involved in with Murray in his venture. So I remember actually that was actually her first startup involvement when I met her for the first time. She was really excited about this whole startup thing, and that's what we leveraged to talk her into joining Sunnybrook's board.
Ah, so small world, because I know Maria quite well.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and, you know, she's on the board of Broadcom now and Microsoft, so I do reach out to her periodically.
Absolutely, yeah, she's an incredible lady. She was she went from UBC to Princeton. She stayed on our board from Princeton. I remember a lot of board calls was her in her home vacuuming during the call.
Yeah, in fact, she's the president of Harvey Mudd, right, which is quite
yeah, exactly.
A high-end sort of elite college in the U.S. Now, you talked about licensing in terms of your experience and your background. So what are your tips for licensing negotiations?
Well, make the deal happen, right? Licensing is an interesting situation because unlike the exchange of, you know, a normal marketplace, like licensing is all intangible. So normally, when you negotiate a deal, you've got something, a product, a device, something, and the other party wants it, right? And you agree on the price that is high enough that it fulfills your desire and low enough that the other person gets value out of the deal. And that's fairly straightforward. I mean, those negotiations happen every day. We all do them, and so they feel very familiar. Doing them at a larger scale just means a larger scale. Licensing is different because patents aren't property in the conventional sense. There aren't objects, right? It's not like selling your car or selling your house or selling product in your company. It's intellectual property. So it's abstract, intangible. It's in your mind. And that creates an interesting conundrum because basically you have two things to give. You have the intellectual part to give. In other words, the knowledge, the know-how, the information. And then you have the actual property part, which is the patents, the things that legally give you ownership of that intellectual creation. And that creates a very delicate negotiation process because normally when you sit on a negotiation table and you want to sell your car, let's say, you have your car, the other party can't just take your car. And if you want to sell the car, you can give the other person a test ride and they can try it out and they can look under the hood and they can do really whatever they want in exhausting detail. because they can't just drive off with the car. If they do, then the cops come and they get arrested. With intellectual property, that's not quite true, right? If you do the equivalent of letting them look under the hood, that means exposing them to the proprietary, to the secret parts of your technology. At that point, they have the intellectual aspect already. They already have the ability to make the product. Now comes just the property thing. And the difference there is that if somebody steals your car, the police comes and arrests them, you know, at no cost to you. There's an entity that, you know, basically fixes those kind of theft issues. That same example, that doesn't exist for intellectual property. Intellectual property, if somebody steals your idea and makes a product, then nothing happens at all. You have to actually, at your own cost, sue them for intellectual property infringement. And that's expensive, and that's painful, and there's many jurisdictions like China where that's very difficult. So it's possible, but it's sort of a recourse of last resort. So licensing negotiation, my biggest tip would be learn how to sell without showing, right? That's a much, much harder skill set in my experience than doing a straightforward transaction, because you have to find a way to paint a picture, to paint a vision, to convince people that you have something magical for their future in their hands, in your hands, but they have to pay you first, and then they'll get it. So you have to be a bit of a magician in the process.
Now, do you have any kind of sense of, or I guess you would, from the negotiations that you've done, but maybe in a broader sense, the kind of ranges of deals that are made from a percentage standpoint on licensing?
Certainly. Now those vary a little bit from industry to industry, but in, let's say, the consumer electronics and software industries are the space that I'm familiar with. Usually most devices have anywhere, you know, between 5 and 15, maybe up to 20% of intangible royalties and other consideration baked into their bill of material. So if you look at a mobile phone, let's say, you know, it might have a $200-$300 bill of material, that's all the cost basically that it takes to make the thing, including manufacturing overhead and so forth, there will be $20 or so in that of royalties. That's total. Now, that royalty then is split between basically two buckets. There are standards, and there are proprietary royalty solutions. So the standards are, you know, things like telecommunication standards and MPEG and, you know, those kind of things that most mobile phones will, you know, have to get in order to communicate or to show pictures or to, you know, do the kind of fundamental stuff that is governed by standard bodies. And for that, licensing fees are usually standardized. They're set. They vary usually in the pennies, you know, kind of 5 to 30, 40 cents per patent package. And usually you get bundled. So you go to a licensing agent like VIA Licensing, which is operated by Dolby, or MPEG LA for the MPEG series, or a few others. You go to them and you say, okay, I want to get a license to you know, this bundle of, let's say, MPEG technology, AVC or something. So you grab it, you pay your fixed fee, and the licensing pool, the agent deals with distributing that to people. So that's usually, in my experience, somewhere around a third to half of the royalties stack. And then the rest is proprietary solution, and there anything goes, right? So, for example, the Brightside or Dolby's now license of HDR LED technology is a proprietary, non-regulated amount, so they can charge whatever they want. Realistically, for most consumer electronics devices, you end up with royalty rates somewhere between 25 cents to a dollar per device for the proprietary aspects, for a total then maybe of $20 or so.
You know, that's some really valuable insight, and especially from somebody who has done it, and you've done it very successfully. Now, on this next question, I know that you're the general chair of Display Week. Can you talk more about that work?
Sure. So, Display Week, actually, I'm now the past general chair, but it's an annual mandate. But Display Week is the largest technical conference on displays. It's a large symposium that combines a trade show, a large technical conference with about 400 papers being presented, as well as a whole bunch of other events, seminars, and so forth. And it's arranged by an entity called the Society for Information Display, which is in turn the largest association of display technologists and experts in the world. It's an international body. So I sit on the executive board of the SID, the Society, and I've just completed a mandate as general chair for the conference. The arranging that is an interesting opportunity, and that's actually when you talk about tips and lessons and recommendations for aspiring technology entrepreneurs, this is one kind of freebie. I would recommend that people get involved with industry associations in their domain. It's a great opportunity not only to learn and get all the normal benefits you get from going to conferences, but to really interact and build relationships with key executives from all the big players that are usually not accessible. So, for example, the executive board of SID currently has the general manager of Samsung Silicon Valley Lab. It has, you know, people from Apple, from LG, from, you know, large companies at executive levels that are not normally accessible for entrepreneurs. And so, you know, my last decade with the society and now on the executive board has given me some really great relationships with people that really influence this industry.
Again, really good, you know, very sound tips for those in the audience. Now, I know you have all of these patents and additional pending and U.S. applications. You know, from that kind of experience of being a global innovator, what do you see as some of the disruptive innovations upcoming? And I was thinking 2020, but maybe that's too far ahead, maybe even 2015.
Yeah, the world moves quite quickly. So who knows, 2020, we might have flying cars finally. So my job here at Tandem Launch is to forecast innovation, right? I mean, what we do basically is to look into the future about 3 to 5 years out through our industry network, try to figure out what kind of major trends will happen, and then make investments, effectively start companies around those themes to see that, you know, we have some bets on the table when 2015 comes around. So in my world, which is consumer electronics, I see a few major trends that we are heavily invested in right now, and I think will have big impact by 2015, maybe between 2015 and 2020. Environment number one that's clearly getting hot and is wearable technology, right? We're going to move into this sort of world of Internet of Things, and we'll have really two classes of computing devices that currently don't exist or are just emerging. Class one are wearable devices, so things that are attached to your body somehow, whether it's wristbands or necklaces or earbuds or, you know, all sorts of things that are attached to you. And the fact that they're attached gives them the potential to be both the equivalent of your smartphone today, but also get into health, wellness, biodiagnostic, and other kind of things that are connected to you as a person, fitness, and so forth. So we're seeing this, you know, starting to come. I think that will be a major space over the next few years. The second space where those kind of smart technologies will enter is the home. So that's not necessarily attached to you, but that's attached to your principal living environment. And again, we're seeing the beginnings there. Nest was just acquired for $3.2 billion, so that's maybe a bit more than a beginning. But you're seeing these trends that everybody is trying to get into the home environment with smart devices, whether it's ambient control, you know, lighting, thermal, and so forth, like Nest, or smart automation, smart control. There's, you know, the sky's the limit in that space. And then the third area that I see is basically around paradigm shifts in traditional understanding of devices. So give you one example. If you were at CES, you might have seen them, actually. One of our portfolio companies in the space of what we call digital optics, and that's one of those spaces where computational power has increased tenfold every few years. It will continue to increase, whether it's singular or parallel architectures. But there is a fundamental stumbling block, for example, in cameras, which is the optics. And the optics are basically Newtonian physics. It's hundreds of years old. It is what it is. It won't get any better anytime soon. And so using software to solve physics, real-world physical obstacles, or to replace physics, will be tremendously powerful. I think that will be another third major wave that we're going to see that will have impact on just about everything in terms of cameras, displays, multimedia architecture, sound, all those systems that still use physical components, wherever you can use computational solutions to solve those physical barriers, you will get big paradigm-shifting breakthroughs.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You're talking about software solutions to maybe, you know, physics problems, and I think that was an evidence at last Gadget Standing at CES this year, where really quite amazing things being done in software that seemed almost impossible. For example, there was this sort of audio system where you could kind of pinpoint all the different audio sources, let's say in an orchestra, and it's all done through software, or this this visual 3D system where you can overlay faces on top of, you know, different sort of hats and glasses and so on. But it was all done through software. I thought that was just quite amazing, some of these kind of ventures that are occurring. And it's interesting.
Yeah, so if you think about it, Web 1.0, the 90s, was about using software and the internet to effectively replace brick and mortar stores, whether it's Amazon, eBay, and so forth. So that was basically the replacement of brick and mortar commerce. Web 2.0, which is sort of the last few years, was about using software and the internet to replace or augment human-to-human interaction, right? Communication, social media, you name it, all those things. I really believe that the fundamental wave for Web 3.0 has nothing to do with websites. It's going to be this smart replacement of physics, right? Whether you call that Internet of Things, you know, whatever name you have for it, but this notion that we've replaced brick-and-mortar retail, we have augmented or replaced human-to-human communication, the next layer is going to be human-computer interaction through smart devices, through physics-breaking solutions.
It's interesting. I finished an interview recently with the chairman of, or the CEO of the Z-Wave Alliance, and he kind of talked about the same sort of things that are occurring. But something else that I just did an interview with Tom Mitchell, and he's the founding chair of the machine learning department at Carnegie Mellon, and they've created this thing called the Never-Ending Language Learner. And what they've done is they created software, machine learning as sort of a software that is learning to read the web. In other words, it's better today than it was a week ago, and it's better today than it was a year ago. So it's increasingly getting better and better, and I think it's 4 years old now. And they started off with something, I don't know, a few thousand beliefs, and it's now acquired on its own about 70 million beliefs, sort of a kind of fundamental relationship understandings. And then he's doing parallel research in the brain and how the brain kind of looks at and understands words and sentences and their context. And he's marrying those two things. And in fact, those two pieces of research, he's going to meld them in 5 years. And he's saying that perhaps in 10 years, his system will be able to read the entire web and have some sense of what is there and understand it. But there's parallel research in vision and on the kinesthetic side and so on. And then I guess this all leads to this idea of artificial intelligence. And in fact, I have a meeting with Judea Pearl, who won the Turing Award a couple of years ago. And in fact, I have a meeting with him when I'm in L.A. And next week. And, you know, his work is on causality and this whole idea that he's created a mathematical framework called causality. But his earlier work on sort of this causality, you know, sort of causation and so on, and sort of the early work prior to that, Bayesian networks, has allowed all of this kind of machine learning stuff that you see today, even driverless cars and so on. Do you see some of this convergence happening? Maybe in 15 years then, that you're really going to have a kind of a semi-sentient device or operating system like in that movie Her?
I think so. I think, you know, that might be the fourth wave. The thing is, right now there's still too much physics in the world for purely computational or artificial intelligence systems to really do more than knowledge processing. So it's phenomenal. They can go to the web and they can harvest all these beliefs. Problem is, they can't do much with them, right? Once we get to the point that we have a web of devices that are interfaced and that are interactive and that are largely driven and controlled by software and largely adjustable by software, right? Then it gets really interesting, because now you have even fairly unsophisticated artificial intelligences being able to actually do stuff with the world. And, you know, that will have a huge impact on the way we live. You know, I was having this discussion actually just before this call. We have a portfolio company that focuses on intelligent home design. And, you know, we talked about what smart home currently means and what it should mean. And what it currently means is that, you know, not to belittle the Nest or other systems, but basically it means that the human goes in there, punches in the temperature, and, you know, the system is clever enough to make sure that temperature stays consistent. Right? That's good. That's nice. But that's not really intelligent. What's intelligent is my wife. My wife knows that, you know, if it's 6 o'clock, the kids, you know, have to take a bath. And so, you know, she, if she's not at home, she calls home and she says, you know, to me or whoever else is there, say, you know, the kids have to have a bath. And so make sure it's cold outside. So make sure you turn the heater on before you, you know, let the water run for a few minutes. And she gives me all these instructions and, you know, I go and I do all this. And by the time I have the kids in the bathroom, sort of 50 minutes have gone by of heating up water and heating up things and letting water run and all those kind of things that you do, that everybody does. I believe a few years from now, the home will do those things. I believe in a few years from now, the home will go, okay, the kids, you know, the kids came home from school and they had sport today because it's Tuesday and therefore they need to take a bath. And so therefore I'm going to heat up the water in the pipe energy efficiently without letting it run. And I'm going to, you know, burn the boiler and I'm going to turn on the fan and I'm going to turn on the heating system and I'm going to dim the lighting and I'm going to do all this other stuff that human beings, intelligent human beings would normally do to kind of prepare the bath for the kid and just do it. And we won't even think about it. It will just be there. It will just be, the temperature will be perfect and my wife won't have to call and I won't have to do stuff. And that to me is really where genuine intelligence enters, because that needs a whole bunch of judgment and that needs those kind of Bayesian interactions that you just talked about, right? Rather than sort of by rote saying, oh, well, the temperature dropped, so let's increase the heat.
Yeah, it's an interesting world. And, you know, you see Kurzweil being hired as a director at Google. And, you know, it's very controversial. So what are your views on that and the sort of idea of singularity?
Well, there's no reason to believe that we wouldn't be heading that way, right? I don't know if it's going to take years, decades, but so far, you know, apart from issues of faith aside, we haven't really come across any scientific reason why computational devices shouldn't be able to mimic the human brain. That said, I think we greatly underestimate the complexity of the human brain. We still don't fully understand it. And so I am very optimistic that we're going to get a lot of kind of artificial intelligence solutions like the one I just described that are sort of domain-limited, and do what thinking humans would do it for them, having genuine human attributes like creativity, discovery, insight, judgment. That will be really hard, because to engineer systems like that, we need to first understand our neuroscience, our neurobiology, and we don't seem to be anywhere close to understanding ourselves yet.
That's interesting. Again, there's quite a bit of research being done at UCLA and then at Carnegie Mellon and MIT where they're able to somewhat emulate or, you know, when I talk to Tom, he says that they can actually forecast now the neural patterns that are going to occur when a person looks at a word, and their machine learning system can actually forecast what those patterns are. And that's why they're melding their brain research with their never-ending language learner research, because the system is going to have some fundamental understanding, because they're finding some correlation between the two. And I don't know, I think it's pretty amazing. And he talks about the resolution of fMRIs. The resolution is such that they can get a better grasp of what's happening from a functional level in the human brain, and also this magnetic encephalography as well. And combining the two gives them much more information of what's occurring. I guess it's going to lead to a lot of interesting things coming up. Now, this next question is about your career. You've had a lot of successes. Can you talk about what you would consider to be your three top career successes and the lessons learned?
Well, the easy answer is I've got three kids, so they're my biggest successes. But I think you're asking specifically about my job. The big three successes. Well, what I tell people, I coach a lot of entrepreneurs by the nature of my job, and the thing I always tell people is that startups are full of tactical failure, right? Things go wrong all the time. The key is not to be disheartened by tactical failure, and instead make sure that a sequence of, you know, some tactical failures and some tactical successes sum up to strategic success. So strategic to success are the big ticket items. So in that sense, I am you know, I'm extremely proud that at Sunnybrook we built some incredible technology that really got us into the game with some of the largest companies on the planet. I'm very proud that Brightside, the team that, you know, that we built there, was able to take this early idea of LED TV all the way, you know, to Brightside and Dolby era. Most of the Brightside team went to Dolby and worked there to bring it from an idea that you saw to, you know, hundreds of millions of devices. And these days at Tandem Launch, I'm really proud that we built an innovation infrastructure that allowed us to create a whole bunch of companies that are now, you know, becoming Brightsides in their own right. But all three of those successes, if you want, wouldn't have been possible if we had given up at any one tactical stumble, of which there are plenty. I mean, over the last 15 years, I've been at the point of being minutes away from not being able to make payroll at least half a dozen times, right? So not just minor setbacks, real serious near bankruptcy type of stuff. And that's where, you know, the very beginning of this interview, we talked about the things you need. Good and capable people are the only way you don't despair at these tactical failures and keep going. Persistence is the name of the game.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess that's echoed. That was echoed in my interview with Eric Jackson with PayPal. I guess they went through a number of pivots early on, and his advice was you just have to continue through that. Very much like what you're saying, and I guess this is also echoed by Steve Blank and customer development, right, where you're constantly looking at assessing, doing pivots if you have to. So very useful advice. Now, you're a serial entrepreneur, you know, and you're established, well-known for all the successes you had, again, that we talked about. Do you have additional entrepreneurship tips for the audience?
Lots of them. This is what I do for a living, but we only have limited time here. In a quick nutshell, so we already talked about surround yourself by smart people, surround yourself by good people, be persistent, listen to guidance, right? One of the delicate things about entrepreneurship is that you need to be sort of a little bit mentally deranged to become an entrepreneur, right? Because when you start, if you do a rational calculation of cost benefit and risk and reward and all those factors, you know, entrepreneurship is not the best way to get rich, statistically, at least not. It's not the best way to have social standing, at least not statistically, and so forth. So you have to be sort of a bit of an optimist, no, quite a lot of an optimist, and a bit kind of not normal to go on the adventure. What comes natural when you have that personality configuration is to think that you know the answer to everything. You know, it's almost like the personality you need to in order to be an entrepreneur leads you to this flaw of a mix of arrogant and arrogance and not listening to guidance. And so the biggest success factor in my career was working every week, every month, every day almost to suppress that instinctive sense that I know what I'm doing and instead listen to all the smart people that are, you know, around me. And that's, like I said, that's difficult because it comes unnatural to entrepreneurs who, by their nature, have to be a bit cocky.
That's an interesting admission, right? So, and again, useful to the audience. Now, you are the CEO of Tandem Launch Technologies. Can you describe some of your goals?
Sure. So at Tandem Launch, we build companies. So we quite literally architect companies, full teams, fully funded, complete companies, that we incubate essentially from zero to release into the wild world. And so in that sense, my immediate goal is to build as many companies as possible that hit some of these key trends. So what we do is we work with our industry partners to identify those sort of 3 to 5 year trends, and then we assemble usually university technologies from all over the globe, teams from all over the globe around those areas, build world-class expertise in the both technical side as well as the commercialization of those technologies, and then turn them into companies. So goal number one is build lots of those companies. Goal number two is having shown over the last 3 years this model can work, that we can build high-value companies through this process effectively synthetically. We're now in the process of expanding this model, both location-wise as well as domain-wise. So we're currently only working consumer electronics. There's a few other domains that we would like to expand into. And so that's sort of the next big milestone for me, is to bring that model to the broader world.
So it sounds like an interesting model. I mean, are you reaching out into the foreign markets like China?
Yeah, so in fact, we just have a project that we started that they're based in China right now. We're moving them over to Montreal but staying connected to China. So we already recruit globally. We already start these projects globally. And certainly some of the emerging markets are very attractive for us. You want to start, you want to strike a fine balance between having world-class technological foundation, which you generally get from the deep research universities. So we have projects out of Columbia, MIT, and Max Planck Institute in Germany, a whole bunch of sort of deep research centers. And then at the same time, you want the entrepreneurial energy and spirit that you get mostly from, I want to say the cities that have deep entrepreneurial cultures. So Silicon Valley, New York, Berlin, those kind of places. That's where we source a lot of our entrepreneurial leaders from. And then last but not least, you want to look at markets that are maybe not addressed yet, and that's where the emerging markets are really critical and important. And so each project sort of has to have this balance between deep technology, entrepreneurial people, and interesting markets. And, in a nutshell, what we do is synthetically bring those two bits together, unlike a normal, say, accelerator, that would hope for most of those things to have already been formed and then just add money and expertise to help them scale. We really help them first to assemble for the pieces and then scale.
It's interesting. Then do you sort of tap into some of the expertise of, Startup Genome, where they did some sort of research involving, tens of thousands of startups and had some kind of patterns that they think make for great teams, for example, and then something not really related to that, but, the Canadian government has this sort of visa program for bringing entrepreneurs into the country. Are you part of that?
So very regrettably, Quebec is not yet part of the startup visa program. That said, we've had a fairly easy time importing people. To the first part of your question, absolutely. We have a recipe book that, we've sort of learned over the years how to assemble strong teams. And so we're very proud, for example, that 100% of our graduates have raised high valuation Series A financing so far, which if you think about normal accelerators, usually success means half of them raise money or something. We have a very strong track record that we're very happy about. And that comes from having a recipe, I think, to assemble strong teams. And so we really have boxes that we fill where we know, okay, we're going to need a CTO, and a CTO needs to have these kind of characteristics. Doesn't mean that the people that don't have these characteristics can't possibly start a company. It's just, our job is to optimize probabilities. So we know if we get that kind of technical leader and that kind of product leader and that kind of business leader and, those kind of boxes, then we know companies that meet those criteria with those teams can raise money, can scale, can build stuff, and can grow. It doesn't mean that they will automatically succeed, but it moves the probability of success just a little bit higher, which as a fund manager is ultimately all you can do.
I see. So that's sort of like the organizational IP of Tandem Launch. That's your secret sauce.
Exactly. So, for example, we have two startups that are closing financing this week, actually. Both of them are 100% synthetically architected. Literally nobody on the executive team knew each other before we brought the team together. People from all over the world. And, they're both raising at a significant multiple of traditional market value here in Montreal. In fact, at levels that would be high even in Silicon Valley. And that's not because we have some magic access to capital that doesn't care about price. It's because it's a strong team and it's a strong technology. So our job is to sort of architect these pieces in a way that they're very compelling, not just to investors, valuation and investment is an easy measure, but also to other people joining the company, to partners, to collaborators, to employees, and so forth. Because if you create that central nucleus of quality, then you can get other bits around it that will make it even more successful.
So it sounds like you're doing some of the seed round yourself. Do you work with angels and angel syndicates, and then from there, you know, the transition people between angel syndicates and VC? In other words, what are the typical raises that you're doing?
So we actually are a dedicated fund. So we have this incubator program where we build the companies, but we also have Tandem Launch Ventures, which is a full-scale seed fund. So we invest up to about $1 million during the seed and incubation stage. So $500,000 during incubation, another $500,000 up to during the graduation process. So we are sort of, we can write the full ticket to get companies quite far. It's a bit different from a traditional accelerator where you have maybe like $25,000-$50,000. Like if you put $1 million in, you can actually get quite far. So both of these companies that are just raising money this week, just to give an example, this is literally this week, but it's not that we do two every week, but it's not, I didn't prepare those for this interview. One of them is raising around about $4 million. So that's a full Series A with a mix of angel and VC, and they have taken in $650,000 from us, plus we participate in the round a little bit. And then the other one is raising a neighborhood of $2 million. They took $300,000 from us. They graduated a bit early. We are quite flexible. We basically, unlike a normal investor that writes a check, takes equity, and then, you know, whether you use the money or not, during the incubation stage, we basically provide a cash budget to the companies, and then, you know, we take equity for whatever they use of that budget. And so if they can graduate early, if they can move out early, we have less of an ownership, which is effectively an incentive for them to move fast, be frugal and efficient.
So when you're tracking progress then, because you have a cash budget and you're looking at their cash flow, are you using something like a business model canvas, like Alexander Osterwalder's work, or a traditional business plan sort of, or a strategic plan model?
So there's really two separate parts of this. There's the sort of strategy of the company, and for that we use some of the lean startup tools, some of our own homebrew and stuff. I mean, basically, a lot of this stuff is just language around talk and listen to customers, right? I mean, ultimately, that's what it boils down to. So for the strategy, that's exactly what we do. On the operational side, again, Tandem Launch is a little bit different from traditional accelerators in the sense that we don't just provide the money and the early sort of incubation effort. We actually have a full-service operation that provides our entrepreneurial teams with everything they need. So we have a full back office team of four people. We have internal engineering services. We have obviously facilities and lab equipment and so forth and so forth, shared services, IT, back office, you know, all the bits and pieces that they need so that the entrepreneurs and the technologists can really focus on growth and value creation. And while they're in the incubation program, we basically track everything. So we basically deal with all the logistics. And so that ironically makes the first part of your question much easier in the sense that, you know, tracking budgets and so forth, you know, they're basically integrated into our own finance operation at that time, so they don't have to worry about that stuff.
Well, that's fascinating. It sounds like a great ecosystem that you developed there. Now, you know, you talked about your goals as the CEO of Tandem Launch and some of the, you know, the parameters around it and the things that you're looking for. What do you wish to accomplish in the next 3 years?
Well, the immediate goal for us is that broadening of the system. So I think of my life in three-year chunks. So Sunnybrook was 3 years, Brightside was 3 years, Dolby was 3 years. Tandem Launch 1.0, we just finished our third year. We finished our first 3 years. And the goal of the first version of Tandem Launch, if you want, was to demonstrate to the world that this synthetic creation of companies is possible. There's a lot of myths out there, I believe, that, you know, founder magic, you know, people ascribe magic to founders, and I don't think in my own experience I haven't seen that. Obviously, there are some extremely smart people who happen to be there early, and there are some extremely smart people who happen to be there later. You know, I would argue, for example, that Sheryl Sandberg is just as much of a founder in the sense of impact on Facebook than, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, and certainly more than the other four guys, right? So to me, it's more about bringing quality people together. But that was a bit of a heretical thought at the time. And so goal one was to establish that you can indeed build companies that are strong and successful using this method. We've just done that. You know, we've graduated enough companies now that people look at this and go, that's more than just anecdotes. This is real stuff. The next goal for the next 3 years is to expand that model, as I said earlier, both by geography and by domain. Right now, we're operating in Montreal. We bring all the portfolio companies here, at least for the incubation period. That's just so that they have access to the shared services and so forth. But our goal for the next 3 years is to kind of expand this to the point where we can broaden it into other domains, both technical and geographical.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. So I guess, you know, there's this whole movement that startups is now no longer an art. It's more like a science because of, you know, you have Steve Blank with Customer Development, Eric Ries with Lean Startup, Alexander Osterwalder with his business model work, right? So, and it looks like you're tapping into that by using your own expertise and experience to take it to the next level. And I just find it so fascinating. Now, where are the gaps today? Or I should say, you are at a certain point today and you want to be somewhere in the future. What are those gaps and how you close those gaps?
Adding good people. The challenges we have right now at Tandem Launch are basically all people-centric in the sense that we now have enough projects under the hood that we are really seriously starting to hit the limitations of certainly the local entrepreneurial community. Doesn't mean that we hire every single good person in Montreal, but they all have their own jobs, their own projects. And so, we're doing more and more global recruiting. We've always, the technologist of the equation, we've always recruited internationally just because they come from usually the universities that we find the technology at. So they've always been international. The business side, the entrepreneurial side, we've so far recruited locally, not always, but by and large. And that supply is starting to really get exhausted. So we have recently, for example, the CEO of one of the companies that's raising, closing the round on Friday, we moved him up from New York. The newest incubation project we just started, we've moved people over from China. One before actually came from Vancouver. So we're starting to recruit internationally. We are in full swing of it. But that obviously has significant challenges, both in terms of logistics, but also just in global outreach. And so one of the things that we're currently working on are partnerships with incubators, accelerators, and networking organizations across the globe to sort of, if you want, secure our supply chain. We have a recipe now on funding and capital to build companies. We have technological ideas and the human supply chain, if you want, of talent is something that we're addressing right now.
So when you're doing, VC financing, are you going to the Valley, I mean Silicon Valley, or are you being able to do that within Canada?
So Tandem Launch is deliberately set up to be an international operation, and so we don't have any restrictions. You know, a lot of the funds that are Canadian have money from the Canadian government or from the provincial government, and they'll have some restrictions. You know, their portfolio companies have to stay in the province and so forth. We very carefully made sure we have none of those restrictions because our portfolio companies might very well end up not just raising money from the Valley, but also going to the Valley, moving, relocating. Ultimately, it's global companies that serve the global marketplace, so they need to retain that flexibility. That said, there are some really good funds in Canada, emerging. The Canadian VC ecosystem is definitely on an upswing. It's getting better. And so we've had an opportunity to work with some very strong local partners as well as international investors.
You know, it's surprising all the things that you've been able to accomplish, or maybe not surprising considering your background, but as you go through all the work that you're doing, there's got to be something where you go, wow, I didn't anticipate that. Oh, man, that caught me off guard. So what surprises you?
Everything, every morning. No, seriously, if you can't live with ambiguity, uncertainty, and surprises as an entrepreneur, then get a different job. In hindsight, I can look back at the last 15 years and explain exactly which actions and which decisions led to which outcome. But forecasting is extremely difficult. If you told me 10 years ago that I would be effectively a fund manager today, I would have laughed at you, right? 10 years ago, I was on a crusade. We were Brightside was entirely financed by common share investment. We raised a total between Brightside and Sunnybrook 9 rounds of financing, all common share, which at that time was practically a miracle in Canada, anywhere really, because most of the time it would be preferred share VC investment. But especially at that time, post-dot-com bubble, it was unheard of. We were crusaders, we were zealots. We even had articles written about us about, you know, this new way of financing companies and so forth. So if you had told me that, you know, 10 years later, I would be effectively a venture capital fund manager, I wouldn't have been able to predict that. That said, we were able to make the changes. The reason why I disliked venture capital money at Brightside wasn't the venture capital nature itself. It was some of the structural restrictions, such as having to stay local, such as having these weird incentive dynamics around payout that you get when you have liquidation preference and so forth. So at Tandem Launch, you know, the surprise in hindsight was that we were able to change some of the stuff. We were able to go to the marketplace and say, we want to run a VC fund, which is what Tandem Launch is at the heart of it. If you ignore all the fancy incubation stuff, we are a VC fund. We want to run a VC fund that doesn't have a management fee, that doesn't have carried interest, that doesn't have local restrictions, that doesn't have all these things that we found be an inhibitor for company growth when you take VC money. We will be able to get rid of all this. And the big surprise for me was that once we've shown some results, the investment community said, yep, we understand why you're doing this. We like the reason why you're doing it. Let's do it. So I think I can guarantee you we're the only fund in Canada, possibly in North America, that has neither management fee or carry. It's doable. So the surprise is always, to me, if you do what you say you're going to do and you do it well, it's surprising how many rules of thumb get thrown out of the window when people see a good thing and want to jump on board.
Now, you talked about your work being in sort of three-year cycles. So, you know, Brightside, 3 years, Dobie, 3 years, Tandem Launch, phase one, 3 years, Tandem Launch, phase two, 3 years. What are you going to do next?
Who knows? Well, that was actually one of the big learning lessons. So in Brightside, when we set up the company and we aggregated all these intellectual property pieces and all these technologies from different universities, in hindsight, we made one mistake, and that's what Tandem Launch is trying to fix. So in hindsight, the mistake we made at Brightside was that we bundled everything together into one entity. So when it came time to basically sell the company to Dolby, which was absolutely the tactically right step for the main technology, LED TV, going to a multi-billion-dollar licensing company was the best mechanism, not just to make money for investors and us, but also to bring the technology to the next level. It needed that kind of stamina to negotiate these major deals with Sony and so forth. Unfortunately, at the same time, on the same company, in the same building, in the same entity, were a bunch of earlier stage technologies that could have been developed further or maybe could have become companies in their own right. And so in the sales process of Dolby, there was really no way to disentangle them. They all got sort of sucked up, and some of them Dolby pursued and most of them Dolby didn't pursue just because it, you know, wasn't the right stage for the technology and for the company at that time. And so the lesson from that is that this incubation model of building teams around university technologies works really well. Economically, it works really well. But don't bundle everything together. And so in many ways, the genesis of Tandem Launch is what was basically, how do we get the same results, the same economic and startup creation benefit of Brightside, but do so in multiple entities? And that's essentially why we're now structured as a fund that basically has large ownership stakes in a whole bunch of companies that then individually can drive. You know, and some of them will reach the point where it's the best thing for them to do to sell themselves to Dolby or somebody like Dolby. And others will go on and become big manufacturing companies of themselves. And so the net result of this is that Tandem Launch doesn't have a time limit to it the way Brightside did, right? Tandem Launch, the portfolio companies might come and go, but I do see myself for quite a few more three-year cycles growing Tandem Launch to its own evolution of, you know, single-point incubator, multi-domain incubator, and then global incubator.
Right, and then Helgi, you'll be on the global stage as you are now, but even more so in Forbes' list.
We'll see. That's a long way to go. But to me, it's just absolutely fascinating that you can build companies, period, that you can build companies. It's a fascinating process. It's fascinating to me that we can sit down here at Tandem Launch, we can talk to our friends at Sony and Samsung and Dolby and others and come up with a vision of, you know, the world would need this in 3 to 4 years, and then sit down and basically artificially build a team and finance it and build some, you know, put some technology and the product together. And 2 years later, lo and behold, the company that emerged from that is now in strategic partnerships with some of these large companies, building product, shipping stuff, making revenue. It's a fascinating process for me, and it's great to watch that you can actually do this, and you can, you know, it doesn't require some sort of divine spark or something where it only happens randomly. You can actually do this. You can, as an engineer, build companies, and that's something I want to do for the rest of my life.
Now, right now, you're immersed in your portfolio companies are immersed in innovation, and so I guess this next question sort of talks about that. How can the world's leading scientific education innovation associations like the ACM, which is the Association for Computing Machinery, play a role in the kind of work that you do?
It's interesting. So I guess there's two elements to this. So there's industry associations. And like the ACM, like SID, like those kind of organizations. And I think what they should do is, in general, open their doors more to entrepreneurs. Right now, a lot of these associations are, for historical reasons, structured in a way that make it very difficult for people that are in startups to join. Obviously, they can join as members, but to join at the governance level, at the executive level, and the, you know, be part of the organization, be part of the program, it's a little bit difficult for entrepreneurs, because most of these organizations require timescales of engagement that are measured in you know, 5 to 10 years. So you sort of surf your way up to the ranks and so forth. Some organizations are better at this than others. But that's, you know, that sort of historically was created to basically for university professors and industry executives, right? And so now we have this new wave of entrepreneurial people, and it would be great if these organizations could provide better access points for those people to get involved, recognizing that an entrepreneur who is in the crunch time for 2 years in the startup will probably learn more about the technology and learn more about the market than a traditional corporate executive in the same 2 years. So that's the industry associations. The second part of the answer are the educational organizations, universities basically. And there's a massive shift needed. I'm giving a talk actually a few weeks from now to about 100 deans of Canadian universities on ways that universities can better address the needs for technology and innovation and entrepreneurship. Universities have a very tough road ahead, right? Universities have kind of gradually moved over the years to go from being centers of scientific learning in the, you know, middle part of the 19th century to basically becoming trade schools in the, you know, last few decades, where most of the people they educate are going to be kind of trade workers, and they haven't really made the leap yet to either train entrepreneurs or even build structures that encourage entrepreneurship, right? Some universities again are better than others at this, but in general, a very small people of, you know, a very small number of students at universities are prepared to be entrepreneurs, are being encouraged, coached. And the principal thing that universities, I think, need to do in their curriculum is they need to teach people how to create their own events. But by which I mean is that you have to psychologically and emotionally have people understand that they can do stuff. They can take actions that have global impact, and universities don't teach you that. Universities teach you a very linear kind of understanding of the world where, you know, the stuff you do doesn't really matter. If you get a good grade or bad grade, nothing changes in the world. And everything is sort of prefabricated for you, your exams, your courses. And that's the antithesis of the entrepreneurial lifestyle. So if there's one thing universities can do is to teach people that they themselves can build companies and can do stuff that has impact.
Okay, so I have a follow-up then. I mean, I found your sort of answer really interesting. I guess the ACM can also play the role of an educator as well, because they have so many services like their digital library and so on, which can help in doing the research. On the university side, it's interesting. How would you rank UBC?
UBC is doing surprisingly well. So when it comes to technology transfer, which is, I guess, one measure of output, they're probably the best in Canada. They're one of the top 10 public universities in the world in tech transfer at standard rankings. So that's good news. When it comes to the basic student training, UBC does more than most universities, Waterloo being sort of the superstar in Canada. UBC is probably maybe second, maybe third place. They're doing quite well. The problem is that all those measures, whether it's tech transfer success or entrepreneurial education, are against a very low standard, right? Being one of the top 10 public universities in tech transfer just means that you suck less than all the other ones. I'll give you some numbers. In the U.S., U.S. universities 2 years ago, last year, 2012, I guess, this is the last statistics I have. In 2012, U.S. universities spent about $55 billion on basic research, $55 billion on research funding on the STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. So ignore the arts and so forth. $55 billion into stuff that creates technology. Out of that have emerged less than 200 licenses or companies that have gone off and spun off the university. That's, you know, $90 million or so. If I do the math right, I probably am not. But you give me that much money and I built you a company. I built you quite a lot of companies. Right, so being the best in that comparison isn't great. Like take UBC as a specific example. UBC has $1 billion R&D budget, research funding budget. They generate maybe $20 million a year in tech transfer. That already is sufficient to make them the best in Canada. But turning $1 billion of research and turning it into $20 million of commercialization, you know, that's better than the rest of Canada, but not precisely worth celebrating.
You know, you just love the answer. And I guess it's a sort of a segue into this next one. And what are your sort of areas of controversy that you want to talk about?
Ooh, too many. I think one of the big social controversy that is hitting us as a society is that working will no longer be necessary, right? I mean, somewhere, if you look at society over the last 1,000 years or so, as far as we have data, what happens is that work hours have statistically declined, work hours per week, and that trend of consistently declining work hours has only slowed down in the 60s and 70s, 1960, 1970. Up to that point, you know, every period of time, work hours have dropped, and the extra time has been turned into leisure time, and the leisure time has spawned social progress that has inevitably, in the long run, been good for society. So in the Middle Ages, you know, some form of early industrialization happens, and so some people have some extra spare cycles, and those spare cycles go into learning how to read, and that enables the printing press to actually get distribution, and so forth and so forth. In the, you know, Industrial Revolution, people, you know, work less, so they have even more spare time. That spare time turns into basically laborers becoming white-collar tradespeople and a bourgeoisie, you know, a sort of a middle class emerges. So that's socially good, and so forth. So you look through history, and you have this overarching trend. If you zoom in onto every period, there's major disruptions, right? There's revolutions during the Industrial Revolution, but like real revolutions. There are, during the Middle Ages, you have lots of social upheaval as the middle class forms. You have religious wars during that period. Like any period, there's this big sort of localized in time upheaval to deal with this transition of more available time. And I think we're going through this period right now where basically through progress in automation, in, you know, robotics, in software, people should probably be only working 20 hours a week on average. It doesn't mean that, you know, the leaders, the people that are either scientific or entrepreneurial or corporate leaders will always work long hours. They always have. But the average of the population probably needs 20, maybe 25 hours a week of productivity, and the rest is all fake work. And so right now, as a society, we have to come to grips with this world where people just don't have to work that much anymore. In the same way that in the Industrial Revolution, people had to come to grips with the fact that really 40 hours a week is enough, 80 wasn't needed anymore. We're facing a similar reduction, right? And that will come with a lot of social shift. And one of the social shifts that universities and educational institutions and at government have to deal with is that, less work time doesn't make you less valuable, right? So both at an economic level, that means salaries have to be increased to compensate for that, but also at the social level, right? You're not an outcast because you only work 20 hours a week. You're socially accepted. That's what you're supposed to be doing. Just in the same way that's become socially accepted now to work 40 hours and not 60 hours anymore as a normal employee. And B, they have to restructure our educational system to prepare people for that universe, to prepare people for a world where an even smaller percentage of people will be the creative drivers of innovation, the creators of these new softwares, of these new robots, of these new artificial intelligences, and so forth. And the larger body of people will just work less and have a happy life assisted by all this technology. And if we don't come to grips with this, then, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement and the all these movements that we have right now will just be the beginning of a big wave of social upheaval.
That's quite interesting, your views on that. And I guess now sort of extending into possible areas of controversy is these next three questions, one of which is, what are your views on this sort of growth and free content?
Well, it's inevitable. One of the consequences of what I just said a minute ago is that people will have more leisure time. And leisure time can be spent in two ways, right? People can waste their time, you know, just drink beer, sit in the corner somewhere. And that will happen, and we have to accept as a society that that's acceptable. I think one of the main reasons, for example, why things like a universal income, which I think would be a very good idea, is socially so difficult to accept is because everybody has this vision that people will be freeloading, right? They will take all their time, all the money that society gives them, and they will just waste it. And that will happen. There will be some percentage of that. But the human mind is quite curious, and boredom is the bane of all human beings, whether they are, you know, the next great scientist or just a normal person who doesn't have to work as hard anymore. And that curiosity needs fuel, and that's content, right? So the printing press wasn't invented in, you know, the Renaissance period, early Renaissance, because people invented the printing press. The printing press came into existence because people had time to read, right? And I think the free content is sort of the same thing. If we, on the one hand, reduce work time to the point that people have more leisure time and assume that some of the leisure time they will look for interesting things to do that will ultimately be socially beneficial, but not in the sense of work, in the sense of reading was socially beneficial in the Renaissance, then we need to provide them that fuel. We need to provide them free content. We need to provide them with open access. Obviously, I'm not naive. There's a million things logistically that have to happen to make that possible. You know, I mean, during that aforementioned printing press period, people fought a 30-year war in Europe over religious differences of who gets to read the Bible. But ultimately, that was one of the earliest free content disputes, right? You had the establishment saying, no, that stuff should stay in Latin and should stay, you know, read only by the priests, and you should pay an access fee to get into the church to get that stuff read to you. And you had the new community that said, actually, we should all be able to read this, and this should go on a printing press, and this should be available in every household. Access to academic journals is no different. Hopefully we don't have to fight a 30-year war over it, though.
And I guess the sort of the next question is, you know, crowdfunding. Now, you talked about you really, in essence, are a fund manager in some aspects. What do you think about crowdfunding and what's going to happen there?
I think crowdfunding is fundamentally healthy. The challenge is that it will need to be very well regulated. A lot of these initiatives are driven by technologists, and as technologists, we often tend to overlook that the vast majority of the population is not like us. In other words, it's very easy to say, okay, you know, normal people should be part of the funding process for startups. That's good for innovation. That's good for startup creation. And that's good, in theory, for economic return for those people. And so that's all true, and that's all nice. The problem is that what we don't understand is that we have an intensely personally regulated system. I'm an active angel investor aside from Tandem Launch. And so between Tandem Launch and my angel investments, I meet people that pitch me for money all the time. Not a week goes by when somebody doesn't pitch me for money. And I have a whole bunch of expertise and processes and feedback mechanisms and tests and due diligence mechanics to basically find out whether it's a good investment or not. Doesn't mean I always bet on winners, but it means that I have some protective provisions that ensure that I invest diligently and, you know, don't risk all my money on one bet and so forth. But I have that because I am in this environment. Most regular people don't have those protective mechanisms because they just don't have the experience of it. And so they're can be fall victims of scams very easily, and not just scams in terms of deliberate malicious scams, but just scams that are effectively scams, where everybody is well-intentioned, but people don't do proper due diligence, don't fully understand what they're getting into, and then suddenly all the money is gone. And that, I think, is the big risk of crowdfunding. So I think in the long term, what we're going to see is a stable system where there is a crowdfunding ecosystem, and it will have similar legislative and logistics regulations as the public markets, effectively, because they will be public markets. They will be effectively junior, will be, you know, pre-junior stock exchanges.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about some kind of protection mechanism. I guess that will happen with equity crowdfunding. You know, you have Title III of the Jobs Act. Some of those elements should be appearing in April this year, even though the Jobs Act came out in April of 2012. So Title III being the equity part of where you have unregistered investors, or non-accredited, I should say, investors being able to invest. But there's all sorts of regulations and policies and rules around that to try to protect the consumer. I'm not sure, though, if it's going to be that way with donation-based, reward-based, or even maybe even around some of the debt financing kind of elements of crowdfunding. Do you have any views on that?
I think the regulation will ultimately have to come, right? I mean, think about the way laws are made. So usually what happens in democracy is that things are unregulated, markets emerge, the first wave of people make money, the second, and then something goes wrong, right? And usually something goes wrong dramatically. Something blows up, there's bad news, people get upset. And so lawmakers step in and go, oh man, we have to prevent this thing from happening again. And so they pass laws that are usually fairly specifically targeted at, you know, preventing that one issue from coming again. And then the cycle continues. And so it takes a while, it takes years, maybe even a decade, to build up a sufficiently broad body of laws that has covered sort of the first wave of things that can go wrong. And that's when you finally have a regulated system, and that's usually what emerges. Like, when you look at crowdfunding, sort of Kickstarter-like non-equity funding, that used to be entirely non-regulated, right? And then a whole bunch of things would go wrong, and so people would go after Kickstarter and say, hey, you know, you sold me this product, it's that product on your website, you sold it to me, you, Kickstarter, are liable. And before you know it, Kickstarter, you know, revamps their entire website and says, these are not products, these are just donations, and stop using the word products and stop showing videos. And that's a form of regulation, right? That this is intrinsic self-regulation of Kickstarter. But you also have a lot of legislative efforts that are underway right now to provide, you know, to create boundaries around this stuff. And that's normal. And there will be some winners and some losers on this. But ultimately, well-regulated systems are healthy for society.
You know, your answer brings up this whole concept of something like something going wrong. And then that will then spawn some additional RIP policies and regulation around it. And I guess I'd like your views then on digital currencies and what's happened with some of the failures that occurred with Bitcoin.
Well, you know, Mt. Gox blowing up is a good example of something going wrong. but again, this is healthy, right? It's maybe not healthy if you were a speculator in the system. But, I mean, the word that you use is digital currency. And right now, Bitcoin isn't currency. Right now, Bitcoin is basically a digital collector's item. It's like having baseball cards. You know, they have a price, they fluctuate and so forth, but it's not a currency unless you can actually use it for exchange, right? And yes, you can exchange it in small places here and there, but the vast majority of the value of the Bitcoin ecosystem is stuck in speculative trading, not in exchange for goods and services. And ironically, the one thing that something needs to go from a collectible to a tradable good to a currency is regulation. As much as the libertarians behind digital currencies don't like that, eventually I can guarantee you that there will be regulatory controls that make it a viable currency. The question is, do those regulatory controls come from the legislator? In other words, government passes laws. Do they come from the technology side, so the protocol itself, right? I mean, remember, the Bitcoin protocol is going through constant modifications to avoid these kind of issues, right? And that's a form of regulation as well. It's built into the technology rather than into the legislative body, but it's regulation nevertheless. And, you know, that body will build up, those regulations will build up until you get a stable system, and eventually, maybe not through Bitcoin, maybe through Bitcoin, but through one of those digital currencies for sure, you will have something that actually is a currency. That said, I think it's a bit delusional of people to assume that it will be A, non-regulated, it certainly will be, and B, it has to be, otherwise it won't be a currency, and B, that it will be free transactions. Because think about it, what is a 100% digital currency today that works perfectly, that's regulated, that has a small fee attached? It's called credit cards, right? There's a whole ecosystem that's sprung up over the years to provide essentially digital exchanges. It's been a long time since I handed a dollar bill in some sort of online transaction, right? It's basically a digital currency. It just has a dollar sign in front of it, but it's basically digitally moving around. There's no backup of that currency in any real sense, no gold standard anymore. And, you know, companies emerge to charge a small fee, just like the Bitcoin exchanges charge a small fee, and soon there will be small fees for transactions, and those fees will include things like insurance and regulatory compliance and reporting and all the things that have to happen. And that's normal. That's called, you know, living in society.
Now, Hage, we're down to our last three questions, and this one's pretty broad in that, you know, you're in the entrepreneurship space, startups, investments, and so on. Do you want to see some improvements in policy in the next couple of years, and what would you like to see internationally?
Ooh, it's a long list of things that I'd like to see changed. At the highest level, governments have to come to grip with the fact that what everybody talks about, the knowledge economy, has arrived, right? And so that means governments need to genuinely understand that a relatively small number of really merit-based people, more and more so intelligent, hardworking, you know, good people, will create the vast majority of local geographic wealth in each location. So the name of the game becomes to get an unfair share of the world's supply of those people. That's really what government policy should focus on. And now that cascades down into policy changes, make immigration as easy as possible. In fact, turn immigration offices into recruiting offices. That's what I would do if I were Canada. Provide government and regulatory support for seed stage financing. Change educational policies to, you know, focus more on that small percentage of people that can actually create companies and create wealth and so forth. Create policies in the labor market that deal with the fact that most people won't have a job anymore and that that's okay and acceptable if they only work 20, 30 hours a week. And then change the core economics to provide ways for startups to grow. Now, everything I just said is a very long list of very difficult things. It's a big social change. But it's no different of a social change than we've gone through in, say, the Industrial Revolution with the creation of a middle class.
Okay, you do a lot of traveling. You're internationally renowned for all the work that you've done. Great success history. So from all of this extensive speaking, traveling, and work, do you have any stories you want to share?
Lots of stories. Give you one story of the ups and one story of the downs of startup to give people a sense of perseverance. So a decade ago, here we are. We're running almost out of money, we have a month left or so. And we have an offer to acquire the company at a very high return. Everything is good. And all that has to happen, we'd already told the team, we have told everybody, you know, we're going to sell this company, a big exit. Everybody will be happy. Everybody has a job. It's all a great story. All we had to do is we had to fly from Vancouver, where we were based, to Paris, where the acquirer had the headquarters and potential acquirer. And the deal had worked out. We just had to have one big meeting with the board of this is a giant public company. With their board to kind of, you know, seal the deal, handshake and so forth. So, you know, I'm in the plane, I'm flying to Paris, I'm all excited. This is my first big economic success, or hopefully success. I land in Paris, my colleague and I sit in this room and wait for the meeting, and the meeting, the guy doesn't show up. 20 minutes go by, half an hour goes by, nobody shows up. We go out in the hallway and go, okay, is there anybody here? Whole hallway is empty, everything is deserted. We finally flag down somebody who was walking around and go, oh my God, yeah, There's this big company-wide meeting right now, all-hands meeting. The board has just fired the CEO. Half the board is gone. Half the executive is gone. And, you know, the shareholders have decided to take the company private again, buy it back from the public market. So there end every dream I ever had. Acquisition out of the window. Everybody we ever talked to had been fired. We literally never saw any of these guys again. We just flew home. And I spent the whole flight trying to figure out, how do I tell my employees that, you know, we've just, in the matter of a few hours, gone from everybody being rich or comparatively rich to everybody pretty much being unemployed in a month or so when we go bankrupt. So that was one of the downs of the startup. So we went home and we, you know, we sat down with everybody and we explained to them honestly what happened. And you know, it was no fault of our own, but nevertheless, the opportunity is gone. So now we have to get our act together. We're going to raise some more money. We're going to kick in some of our own money from the management team. Management team stopped paying themselves salary and so forth to get the ship back on track. And we did, and we built it again. Fast forward a year later, we've just got everything back on track. I go to a trade show, one of my colleagues went to a trade show and comes back from the trade show and goes, we were showing this demo, and actually the demo that you saw on the HDR display. And he goes, we showed this demo, and in this demo we have some clips that we kind of didn't license, just some demo videos to be downloaded from like a website or something. And so he said, there's this guy coming that came to our booth from Dolby, and he kept talking about our content, and so we've been dodging him. But, you know, just be warned, if you go to the next trade show, these guys might be harassing us because we're using content that we didn't have ownership for. So we go to the next event, and this Dolby guy shows up again and says, you know, I really need to talk to you guys. And we try to dodge him. And this keeps going on. For about 3 months, we try to avoid this guy. Until finally, we get an almost angry communication that says, come on, guys, I know you're playing hard to get. We want to buy you. Can you finally come to the table? And so that's an example where, you know, the first acquisition attempt was carefully planned and orchestrated and failed miserably, not because of it, but by random luck. The second one, we tried to avoid the issue because we thought he was trying to go after us. And it turns out to be the big success of the company. So the moral of the story is perseverance is key. Recovery from tactical failures is key. And sometimes luck is just around the corner as long as you just talk to people and listen.
You know what? That's a great story. I'm sure Maria is sort of experiencing something similar in some aspects on the board of Microsoft. But anyways, I guess it's another story. But this last question is kind of open-ended in the sense that I reverse it. And I do that by saying, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, the question I would ask is, how does somebody start a tandem launch? And the answer is by sending me an email and telling me whether they want to build a company.
So, again...
Hey, I've got to do some promotional work here. No, I'm just kidding. All right, so questions you would ask me for real. I would ask myself, what's the hardest thing about being an entrepreneur? I talked a lot about tactical failure and recovering from it and so forth. The hardest thing in my experience is that entrepreneurship, building of companies, only work, as I said in the beginning, when you surround yourself by capable and good people. The problem is capability you can maybe judge, not all of the time, but you get reasonably good. Goodness, you can't. And so the tough part is that quite frequently you will add people to your team, as co-founders, as employees, as, you know, whatever it is, partners, and you will learn over time that they don't have the, you know, fortitude and stamina to last through the bad days. And that's by a wide margin the toughest thing in a startup, when you have to part ways with people that are nice, that are hardworking, that are intelligent, but don't have the ability to make it through the valleys. And the people that can't make it through the valleys, either because they can't emotionally deal with it, or simply because they get upset, or they get angry, or they get disappointed, or disillusioned, or you name it, for whatever reason can't make it through the valley, will almost inevitably be the people that also can't make it to the peak. And that's the tough lesson I've learned over the last 15 years. is that if you don't have that core team of good people, you won't make it to the peak, which means you have to be on this continuing quest of testing the people you have and adding new people because some of them won't work out.
Yeah, that's a good sort of a couple of questions and answers, and very insightful and really a tremendous value to the audience. And I know your schedule is really, really busy and very demanding, so we were indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, and thank you for sharing so much with the audience.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for the interview. Hope everybody enjoys.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Helge Zietzen, pioneering chairman, CEO, World Innovation Technology Leader.